Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Monkeypox, a non-fatal virus most commonly found in Western and Central Africa, is spreading. An outbreak of the virus occurred in the United Kingdom in May. Numerous confirmed cases have since sprung up in North America and Australia. While the virus itself is worrying, albeit non-fatal, the public-facing image of monkeypox presents another very real threat, one of stigma. Dr. Andrew Lee is a family physician and professor of public health at the University of Sheffield in England. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
So what is monkeypox?
So basically, it's a viral infection, as you know. It's a cousin of smallpox in a way. And it's one of those infections that causes this awful eruption on the skin, really ugly, disfiguring pustules all over the body. And normally people will get better after 3 to 4 days, as you've rightly said. So it's usually non-fatal.
Can you distinguish between monkeypox and smallpox, and why one is so dangerous and the other not so much dangerous?
Okay. Well, thankfully, we've not got smallpox around these days.
Right.
Otherwise, it would have been difficult to distinguish between the two. And indeed, if you go back 20, 30 years, when the world was trying to eradicate smallpox, they had difficulties trying to work out which one was smallpox and monkeypox in West Africa, for example.
It's endemic to Western and Central Africa. Why? What does that mean, that it's been under control? It doesn't spread that fast? What does it mean?
Okay, so the picture in Western Central Africa is interesting. It's been grumbling along now for 20, 30 years, and it has several thousand cases every year. So it's there. It's in the background. Every now and again, they do get larger outbreaks, and they do occasionally get cases that spill over outside of these endemic areas to other countries. For example, the US, you've had cases over the years as well.
Why do they call it monkeypox?
It's a terrible name, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And in a way, it's a misnomer, because you would assume that you've caught it from monkeys, and it's not true. In Africa, a lot of the cases are acquired from rodents, actually. So it's maybe if they called it rodent pox, it would have been more appropriate.
Doesn't roll off the tongue, though. The spread of the virus has been associated with sexual contact, and therein lies the rub, right? So why sexual contact?
Okay, so the main thing about monkeypox, and in a way it's a bit like chickenpox as well, if you think about it, yeah? The way people catch it or spread it is through close physical contact. So you've physically got to touch a contaminated lesion or skin scales or contaminated linen and bedding, for example. It's that close contact, and you get that when you're being intimate and you're having sexual contact, for example. So that's where the link is made. But strictly speaking, it is not a sexually transmitted infection in the traditional sense.
Right, because you could shake hands with somebody and get it?
Yeah, it doesn't spread that easy. So before people panic and think, oh gosh, I'm not going to shake anyone's hands, you do probably need quite a bit of close physical contact. Yeah. So if you look again to the African setting, often the cases are in households, so family members, kids rubbing up against one another, that sort of thing.
You've connected the social aspects of monkeypox to those associated with HIV/AIDS. How so?
Yeah, unfortunately, at the present time, we are seeing the cases of monkeypox spread in men who associate as gay, bisexual, or men who have sex with men. And the danger here is people start to label it as gay disease. And this is very similar to back, if you go back to the 1980s when HIV/AIDS first emerged, it emerged in this group, and the association, the link was made there, and then the stigma came with it, and the links to morality and concerns and that kind of prejudice and discrimination can be quite harmful.
It can be harmful because people might not seek treatment when they should.
Exactly. Exactly. People might be ashamed, embarrassed. They might be concerned. They don't want to be outed, going to a sexual health clinic or getting health care for that. So that's one reason. And of course, even within the community of gay bisexual men, for example, they might feel ostracized by others within the community if they are identified as a case of monkeypox. So we've got to be really careful here that we don't generate it, the stigma, because we're trying to stop the spread. And the best way to stop it is to detect it early so that people can take the right action to stop it spreading.
Besides the visible symptoms associated with monkeypox, you talked about the pox marks. What are other, you know, you said it only lasts maybe 3 or 4 days. What are the other symptoms?
Oh, sorry. Normally it lasts, sorry, not 3 to 4 days, 3 to 4 weeks.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
It's all right. It usually starts with vague symptoms, you know, a bit of a fever, swollen lymph nodes, a loss of energy. So those are what we call the prodrome, the initial symptoms. And then after 3 or 4 days, then the rash emerges. And so a person can be ill, as I said, anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks in total.
You focus on medical inequalities in your work. What are some ways that we can see imbalances between different groups, resilience to the virus?
Indeed. So inequalities, or as we call it, isn't just limited to someone's gender or sexual orientation. It can be compounded when you add in deprivation, when you add in their migration status, when you add in their ethnicity into the mix. So sometimes you find people experience multiple layers of discrimination. And this affects the ability to access jobs, access healthcare, affects their quality of life, it affects their social networks and opportunities. All of this has a lot of disadvantage in life, really. And we see it gone.
Is monkeypox, I mean, what do we know about how it, among what kinds of groups or demographics it spreads?
Okay. So previously, certainly for here in the United Kingdom, the cases we got tended to be in travelers who had been across to West Africa or Central Africa. But what changed this May was that we were starting to find cases with no links to Central and West Africa. And predominantly, the vast majority of them were men. Predominantly, the vast majority of these were men who had sex with men, gay and bisexual men. So we were seeing it in this demographic group. And it's unfortunate in this group in a way. It's also not surprising because infections tend to spread within your social networks. Mm. So if you've got an infection, a cold, for example, you're more likely to pass it to your friends and your family, people you come into contact with, and they in turn are likely to pass it within their social contacts and demographic groups. So in this case, that infection landed in this gay bisexual men with sex with men group, and it's spreading within this group because of networks.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about monkeypox. It's a mostly non-fatal virus, most commonly found in Western and Central Africa. An outbreak of the virus occurred in the United Kingdom in May. And my guest, Dr. Andrew Lee, family physician and professor of public health at the University of Sheffield in England, explains that the difference this time and what is worrisome is that it popped up without connections to the usual groups, which are travelers to West and Central Africa. The virus is worrying, but it's mostly non-fatal. And we're talking about about the stigma that can be associated with monkeypox because of how it often is spread in these groups. Can we talk a little bit about the HIV/AIDS history and what happened and what besides the negatives that individuals felt, the stigma and the shame and all of the discrimination, what did the stigmatization of AIDS do to the public health approach to dealing with it?
I think there's so many lessons to learn from HIV/AIDS. Firstly, and for many parts of the world, long before we had HIV/AIDS in Western Europe and North America, there was already this problem spreading in Africa. But it wasn't detected early. There wasn't the investment there wasn't the research needed to find treatments at that point in time, because it was someone else's problem. Mm-hmm. It was an exotic disease. It was over there. Yeah. And even when it came to the US and North America and Europe, when it was limited to initially the gay bisexual group, again, that stigma played in, and it wasn't part of a problem for the wider population. So there wasn't that impetus and energy to look for solutions. So I think that really delayed our public health response and an effective public health response to finding solutions and treatments for this awful disease. And I wouldn't want to see that with monkeypox again, because if we assume that monkeypox is just a gay disease, then we might miss that opportunity to spot when it spills over into wider populations, basically. And does it take away the energy as well and the research and investment into looking for treatments for it?
Well, when AIDS HIV did spill over by way of the blood supply, people who relied on the blood supply for life were stigmatized as well, right? Ryan White.
Exactly. Yeah, indeed. And not just that. So if you look beyond the U.S. again to Africa, it spread into young children from mother to child transmission. Right. And even within those groups, they were ostracized and they were cast aside in a way by society. And for those, even those who survived with treatment, you know, there was a long tail of negative consequences of mental ill health afterwards. So it's not just a short disease and a short-term health issue. It's much wider. It's very pervasive to all aspects of life.
You know, I kind of, you know, when we talk about having a segment like this on the show, I wonder, am I falling into the trap of sensationalizing it, or is this a good practical way to limit sensationalizing monkeypox? What are your thoughts about, like, what the tipping point is and what works to avert sensationalizing it and turning it into stigmatizing it?
Fantastic. That's a fantastic question. And that's exactly what we're grappling with here in the UK as well. How do you get that right level, isn't it? So that you don't stir up too much concern and worry in the public and mm-hmm. generate anxiety and stigma. So a lot of the efforts in the UK are health promotion and messaging is targeted to the target groups through the charities, the LGBTQ charities, working with them to try and get the message out. And the kind of messages we're trying to get to the general population is exactly as you started. It's usually not fatal. Let's start with that, you know. And yes, there are fatalities seen in Africa, but again, the population demographics there are very different to North America and Europe. So I would expect far lower mortality rates, for example. So for most of us, it's a case of, okay, it's there. Yeah, don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't stigmatize. And for people who are at high risk, then it's a case of take sensible precautions, you know, look after yourself, seek help early, and just trying to get that risk in proportion, I think.
And as far as if people want to learn more about monkeypox, do you have a good, reliable source they can turn to?
Indeed. So usually I go to the WHO websites, but one thing you've got in the US, which is the envy for many countries around the world, is you've got a great US CDC, and they have really informative information on their website as well. So I'd certainly recommend your listeners to go there.
Dr. Andrew Lee, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Andrew Lee is a family physician and professor of public health at the University of Sheffield in England. We've been talking about the mostly non-fatal virus monkeypox and the problem of perhaps stigmatizing it because it can be spread through sexual contact. It's certainly not limited to that. You can learn more about it by checking with the CDC and the World Health Organization. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An estimated 1 to 3 in 10 COVID patients might experience long COVID after recovery, even if they weren't sick in the first place, or at least very sick in the first place. Clinics have been established across the country to focus on treating those patients. Dr. David Rosenberg is a director of University Hospital's COVID Recovery Center and the Ahuja Lung Center in Cleveland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Dr. Rosenberg, we're only 2 years, a little over 2 years into this. When did long COVID become an issue of treatment?
After the first several months into the pandemic, there was a lot of chatter on the social media, and individuals were complaining of were voicing all the kinds of symptoms they were having. And, you know, at first the medical profession, you know, wasn't really maybe even considering them as real symptoms. But as time passed, it became that long COVID was a real condition. So I would think, you know, 6 months into the pandemic, it started to be evident this was a real condition.
Is there any other kind of virus or disease like this that has that kind of manifests in a long term condition?
Absolutely. I mean, the classic example is mononucleosis, which can cause, you know, chronic manifestations that last for a long time. But even the common viral colds and influenza, you know, it's clearly been demonstrated in the medical literature that the same kind of chronic type of medical condition can occur.
The thing with COVID has been, I think, just from a layperson's point of view, that stuck out is sort of the impact on the brain and those kinds of things. Is it stand out for you as well?
Well, there's no question. I mean, what's interesting about long COVID, and I may add that, this may be one of the defining illnesses of the 21st century, you know, just like TB and polio were defining illnesses of the 20th century. But there is no question the brain can clearly be affected as almost every body system of the body. I mean, you know, it's been demonstrated that inflammation and even small vessel involvement, vascular involvement can occur throughout. But we see very commonly that neuropsychological and behavioral issues are very common with this disorder.
When the disease hits with such a broad brushstroke, what's it like to try to treat people who are suffering from the long-term effects?
It can be very difficult. And what you need is you need clinicians that really understand the disorder and don't poo-poo it and understand that it's a real disorder. And it's very time consuming. There's no question. And as we'll talk about, you know, the various recovery clinics that have been established, you need clinicians that will spend the time to go through we call it a review of systems, basically from head to toe, asking patients, what they're complaining of, what's bothering them the most, and then sort of prioritize, what is their most important complaint and most serious maybe even, and try and figure out a treatment plan, a diagnostic plan for those symptoms.
Can, I don't think psychosomatic's the word I'm looking for, but can people think they have a long COVID situation when they don't?
Absolutely. I mean, we've actually had, many patients that have wanted to come to our clinic. They've never had COVID, but they have all the complaints. So, you know, that just reflects that there are other conditions, chronic fatigue syndrome that's associated with collagen vascular disorders, mono. I mean, there's a whole host of other types of disorders that can cause similar symptoms and even, you know, behavioral health issues and all the bodily involvement too.
So is there a uniform protocol among all of these treatment centers for long COVID patients?
Well, I think that each treatment center has to create its own culture.
Okay.
And what we've done is realizing that this is a real illness, that it's very, from my opinion, you know, I've been in practice for 4 decades. And I realize that it's very difficult for an individual practicing physician as solo to, I believe, take care of these patients the way they should be taken care of. So what we established at University Hospitals in Cleveland is a multi specialist type of clinic, where we have a nurse practitioner who serves as a quarterback, so to speak, and does a lot of the intake. But we have a whole panel of specialists that we can call upon to seek advice, curbside, or even actually see the patients on a regular basis. So we have found that we really need this panel of clinicians because of the multiple complaints and conditions that they have.
What does it take to become a patient in your clinic?
Basically, anybody who's had COVID. I mean, basically, we would like documentation one way or the other, or a patient's clinician, physician stating that they've had COVID, in the sense that there are patients out there that everybody in the family, you know, has had COVID, documented COVID, and they have all the symptoms, and maybe they didn't get tested, or maybe their test was negative, but it makes sense that they had COVID. So if a patient's clinician feels that they've had COVID or they've had documented COVID, they're clearly welcome to be seen in our clinic.
So can you give me an example of a typical experience one of your patients might have? I mean, they check in, they come in, you do evaluations. Can you tell me what the process is?
Yeah, the process is fairly straightforward in the sense that we have an expert intake person, individual.
The nurse practitioner.
She's actually my respiratory therapist, but she, you know, has all the equivalent of, she's the intake person.
Gotcha.
And she will talk to the individual and get the history, and then she will send them in advance. We worked out with the IT department a bunch of questionnaires that the individuals will fill out electronically if they have that capacity. And these are questionnaires that would deal with their quality of life, their medical history, their fatigue scale, sleepiness scale, depression, anxiety, just to have an overall cognitive issue, to know what their cognitive concerns, you know, with surrounding this illness. And we use the surveys to sort of screen conditions relating to long COVID and to direct us clinically where we may want to do further diagnostic testing or even refer further patients out. So the surveys are critically important to be filled out. We use them clinically.
So maybe my symptoms are chronic fatigue and loss of taste and smell. Is loss of taste and smell something that you're going to try to treat?
Yes, we are. And they're actually, we would consult, and we have protocols working with our ENT department. There are various protocols to stimulate their taste with different types of bitter types of herbs or different kinds of materials. And they can actually try over a period of time to sensitize their neurologic pathways for taste and see if we can recuperate that.
And what about something like fatigue, which is pretty common, I understand?
Fatigue is very common, and it's a disorder. It's a symptom complex that goes along with many types of chronic disorders, and obviously it's one of that's very common with that we're seeing in the clinic. So basically, when somebody has fatigue, we really first of all need to assess them medically to make sure we're not dealing with some type of other medical condition. So we would put them through a complete battery of blood tests, looking for thyroid disorders, other types of anemia, you know, collagen vascular disorders, a variety of things that could cause fatigue. And then, you know, if we believe that it's related to the COVID, we also would think about looking for sleep disturbances. And clearly COVID can cause different types of sleep manifestations that could lead to fatigue. So there's a whole lot of rule out types of conditions that we look for to better gauge our treatment plan for these individuals.
I hate to bring it up, but it's a reality of our system. To what extent does insurance get involved in this and dictate treatments or whether somebody qualifies for this kind of, you know, these therapies and whatnot?
Well, basically for our clinic, I mean, we're not looking, there's no insurance screen. So if they have problems or concerns, then we'll see them in the clinic. Obviously, you know, the where would potentially come into place is the fact that, you know, the various diagnostic tests, you know, cost money. So we basically need to, you know, to charge insurance. So that could be a problem down the line. And along those lines, I should mention that this is is something that's clearly recognized nationally as a problem concern. And also, as you can realize, I'm sure, is that many of these individuals with their chronic issues surrounding long COVID may have to step away from their job or lose their job. And so, you know, finances is a major concern. So there's before Congress, Senator Tammy Duckworth and Representative Presley from Maine and Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, they've submitted to Congress something called the Treat Long COVID Act. And this is pertaining to the kinds of issues we talked about as far as trying to assure that there is some kind of backup of financial support for individuals with long COVID. And even there's been a presidential memorandum along these lines to provide resources to individuals that may need care for long COVID. So I think Congress is recognizing the impact this may have.
Along the lines of work life, and for those who have had their work affected by this, is the treatment for long haul COVID, does it parallel or other occupational kind of rehabilitation?
Well, yes, the treatment plan for COVID, long COVID, one treatment plan is not necessarily the same for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's sort of like a team approach, similar to a baseball team. And then you can pull from the dugout or the bullpen, other types of therapies that you may need. But we would obviously, if there is a specific organ system that is predominantly affected, for example, pulmonary as a pulmonologist, that if there's somebody with fibrosis of their lungs or their asthma is made worse, we would direct the care along those lines. If somebody has a cardiology issue and the long COVID has affected their heart, obviously we're going to get them to the specialists of importance for their particular situation. We've also found that rehabilitative services, behavioral health services, and our Khanna Integrative Health are critically important for these individuals. Integrative health, we found, which treats the mind and the body with various practices, including breathing techniques, yoga, meditation, are critically important. I think the mind body works together, and clearly with Eastern medicine, there are various components of this that I think really can help and promote health and well-being. So I think we've made a holistic approach. It's not that one treatment plan is going to be given for everybody. We really have to treat those individuals as individual patients and come up with the best plan possible.
What's the demand like for COVID recovery clinics?
Much greater than we ever imagined. When we put this together, we started, I think, in August of last year, and we've already seen, close to 400 new patients, and we're in the process now of expanding our clinic, our time. We're going to open up another geographic site besides where we are right now, just to try to meet the demands, and we're doing our best to try and reach out to everybody that needs to be seen, but it's been very difficult, no question about it.
If somebody wants long COVID treatment or wants to be evaluated for long COVID, how do they know where to start? Is it something they do with their personal physician or what?
Yes, I think that's the place to start. Your primary care clinician or physician knows the individual best, and they have dealt with them over the years, and if they believe that they have, a condition related to long COVID, they clearly would make referrals to the specialists in their area, that in the Columbus area, the Cleveland area, throughout mm-hmm. the state or wherever they are. In addition, I should mention, research is ongoing in this area. There's something called the Recover Research that has been sponsored by the NIH. There's two sites in Ohio, at the Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio State, and in Cleveland at University Hospitals in conjunction with Metro Health. Those are the two sites in Ohio that are part of this national Recover Research Grant.
It doesn't sound like a lot of sites for a state the size of Ohio.
Right, well, there's about 90 sites around the country that have been chosen. I mean, it was a process where one put in a request for a proposal application, and the NIH chose the sites with expertise.
Have you, as the clinic, actually helped somebody recover from long COVID?
Oh my gosh, yes.
What's that like? Yeah,
it warms your heart. It really does. You know, when you can make these people feel better, I mean, it really is what it's all about, the clinician. And you know, we've had patients that call us and say, listen, I just got to tell you, you know, the treatment plan that you put together, it's really made me feel so much better. And you know what I got to tell you? I really believe to a major extent, it's having somebody to talk to. You know, what's really lost in medicine today is the art of communication to a major extent. And just having somebody you can call and deal with and voice your concerns and your problems, somebody you know, if you have a problem, you can call. I mean, I think that helps the mind a whole lot, mm-hmm. I got to tell you.
That mind-body connection again. Are there differences in how different demographics are affected by long COVID? Have all these treatment centers, you must be collecting data at this point, right?
Well, that's what the whole recover research is about. And it's really important to serve all individuals, underserved individuals, minority individuals. And the recover research is trying to collect data from individuals that have been suffering most with acute COVID. And because, you know, we have to figure that out because we know risk factors for acute COVID. And we don't know all the risk factors for long COVID, but that's part of this whole recover research.
African Americans were disproportionately affected by COVID. Are you seeing a proportionate number of patients from that demographic in your clinic?
We are. Clearly, we're seeing patients of color in the clinic, and you know, like I said, anybody is welcome to come. Mm-hmm. There's no financial gate they have to jump over, and we'll see everybody. But and part of the research study is to try and determine, you know, and reach all people of need, of color, because these people, unfortunately, have been disproportionately affected by acute COVID.
Dr. David Rosenberg, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. Dr. David Rosenberg is an assistant clinical professor at Case Western Reserve University Medical School. He serves as a director of the University Hospital's COVID Recovery Clinic. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Hepatitis is rare in children, but the sudden and unusually high number of acute hepatitis cases in children has some worried. Dr. Rima Fawaz is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Yale University School of Medicine. She is also the medical director for pediatric hepatology and pediatric liver transplantation. Dr. Rima Fawaz, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
What is the level of concern with these cases?
I mean, we're on alert. These cases, the reason they have raised the global public health attention, they caught attention, is for a few reasons. One, these cases present as unusual severe cases of hepatitis. There is a high rate of hospitalization. And with this hospitalization, there are cases that are go into liver failure, need transplantation, and we've had some death resulting from these cases. So hence the attention caught.
What can parents do about this? It's you can't. How do you stop hepatitis from spreading when you don't know how it's spreading?
A very good question. I'm not sure I have the answer, Anne. I think what we know of right now, it looks like this is caused by virus. The type of injury that we see in the liver, it's what we commonly see with viruses. I think the general principles we apply to good hand washing as prevention of infection, if avoid contact with infected individuals, I think just the routine stuff. I don't think beyond the routine we can do more at this point, but we continue to learn more.
At the outset of an infection, how does it tend to present in these children?
So these kids, the time they presented, they had a high incidence of jaundice, around 70%. Jaundice is the yellowing of the eyes and skin. So obviously that's a flag, that's a red flag that would, you know, get these kids to present to medical attention. But they all had also more gastrointestinal symptoms, such as diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain. But the highest symptom was jaundice in these kids.
And does it come on quickly?
Most of the kids would be sick for a few days and then would come to medical attention. I don't think we have enough granular data at this point to tell you what is the day, how many days to presentation. I think once they present, there is history that they were sick. And the health alerts that came out to educate physicians saying, if you see these patients, please test for the following, so that we have case definitions on these patients.
Is this a new virus of hepatitis, or what's it being labeled at this point?
It's still labeled as acute hepatitis of unknown etiology. I mean, I think there was some, you know, in the Alabama group of patient cohort, there was raised concerns for adenovirus. Mm-hmm. The difference in those case series is that adenovirus is actually a common childhood illness. Most of us have immunity by the time we reach adulthood, so it's very common. The difference in the Alabama group of patients is that they had a serotype, a type of patient that was unusual to cause this presentation, the type 41. Across the globe, not all patients had adenovirus. So depending in the England, in the UK, United Kingdom group, they had a high incidence, anywhere from 50 to 70% of patients had adenovirus. In the US group, it's more like a third, maybe a little bit more, or 50%.
What do we know about why this is attacking children versus the public at large?
We still, at this point, I don't think I can answer your question. I think there are a few hypotheses. One of them is maybe the decreased exposure that kids saw, the kids faced with the COVID pandemic, meaning they got less infections because they were in quarantine, caused an immune gap. And instead of getting used to this virus now, you know, they saw this virus is new. Other theories out there is possible exposure to the COVID infection, and it changes kind of your, it creates an aberrant immune response when you see another virus. What we know of right now is we don't think there is, you know, we don't think it's from the COVID vaccine, because most of these kids were under five and did not receive vaccination. But we still need more information to know whether this is related in some form to the COVID pandemic.
In that the COVID pandemic, either from a lack of exposure to things that would have boosted their immune system, or having the getting COVID one way or the other, because I'm wondering about the immunity gap and it's if that's associated at all with this unusually severe conditions.
It's hard to know at this point. I think we need more information. We need more people reporting on this cases so that we understand better. I'm sorry.
No,
Anne.
Go ahead.
The one thing we saw in the UK, in the United Kingdom group of patients, it happened more during the Omicron surge. Whether it is temporal, whether it just happened during that, it's hard to know. I think people, when these things came up, the global kind of alert, people were worried about vaccination. We know that that's not the case. Many of these kids that were admitted and tested for a slew of viruses had evidence that they had some viral infection in the past 3 months, for example, because when you get infected, you still shed parts of the virus for a while. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we have a direct association at this point, but we strive to learn more as we report these cases.
So you talked about the Alabama cohort. I'm wondering, are these coming up in pockets of kids that maybe are in the same classroom or, you know, go to the same preschool or something like that?
There hasn't been. They looked at to see if there's a toxin. Is it like something they're getting in the environment? And uh-huh. That doesn't seem to be the case. But in the cohorts presented, especially in the UK cohort, there are siblings or exposure, you know, meaning it's an infectious agent. But I don't think there's a toxin that has been identified.
I remember when they found kind of the cure for hepatitis C. I was talking to a hepatologist and or a gastroenterologist. And I asked him then, does this make a big difference in your life? He goes, it's completely changed my life because now he has good news and people are cured and they walk away. When something like this happens, what does it do to your life as a physician in your specialty and field? Are you necessarily busier or are you able to absorb this?
I think the incidence of these cases, Anne, it's still rare. Okay. So it's still reported between 0.5 to 2 per million. So it's not like we're talking about gobs of patients. Mm-hmm. The reason it raised alerts is that there was an increased incidence per year. Like in the Scotland group, which is part of the first UK cohort that was published, they see 5 cases a year and they saw 5 cases in like 3 months.
Okay.
It was just a slight signal increase. But I think now as we learn more, it does seem to be an increased incidence. We're still talking about small numbers. So again, as I mentioned, the raised concern is that they present with more severe hepatitis, which means inflammation of the liver, higher rate of getting admitted to the hospital, and a small, around maybe 10% needing transplant. And that number will continue to change as more cases are reported around the world, right? So a small fraction is needing transplant, and we've had now few deaths.
You are a medical director for pediatric hepatology and pediatric liver transplantation. What do those specialties entail as far as, I mean, how do children react differently to this kind of a disease than adults? What's the treatment protocols? How do they differ? What's different?
So liver transplantation in children, many times the big reason you get transplanted in children, actually, the number one cause is biliary atresia. It's something you're born with. And the second reason is probably malignancy and metabolic disorders. So acute hepatitis, viral hepatitis, is actually a small fraction of what we do in pediatrics.
Okay.
And a cause for liver transplantation. It's a small fraction. So we see it. The cases that were transplanted in the United States, the kids present with severe hepatitis and liver failure. And some of them had needed transplant within a day or two. Like, they're so sick that you need to react and proceed. We're still talking about limited number. As of, you know, now, as of the end of May, we have like 650 cases reported. In the US, 216 cases, and of those, 15 kids got transplanted. We're still talking about small numbers. The reasons in adults are very different. So big one in adults for liver transplantation is ingestions. Tylenol or acetaminophen is a big one, drug ingestions. and then other causes. So it's just a different cause. The reason to get transplanted is different between adult and peds.
And does the cause affect the success rate or the adaptation rate among children? Does that, or is it just too few to know?
In general, kids do really well after transplant in general across like a broad brush. Mm-hmm. And survival rate for us, luckily in pediatrics, is around 80 to 90% at 20 and 30 years, which is incredible. It's the best organ we transplant. If you present with acute viral hepatitis and liver failure, sometimes we can't do enough in the short time we have. So outcome might be a little bit worse because they present sicker, the sicker in, the sicker out. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to give generalization. I think if we can get you, if you come in, present, and you get a transplant and you do well, outcome is very good. It's that acute period when you're so sick that sometimes we can't save you or you have other organ involvement that affects outcome. So it's hard to generalize with that.
When you do a liver transplantation for a child, the liver can come from anyone, right? As long as it's compatible, right?
Yes.
Do you do the whole liver or can you do sections of a liver transplantation?
So you can do sections because the liver regenerates. It's a very unique organ in that. And living donor, you can donate part of your liver. It can be related or unrelated.
And that helps in all of this, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
The children that you see, what do they tell you about how it feels?
As I said, if you look at the reason we do transplants most of the time, if you look at the age group, it's kids under 5 that needs transplantation. So many of them are lucky enough not to remember how sick they were before transplantation. But the outcome, they have a wonderful life afterwards. I think that's very lucky for us that we can counsel parents and say, you know, as opposed to other organ transplanted, the liver has very good outcome. It's the best organ we transplant. And we want their kids to have a normal yardstick compared to other kids, normal life. So in general, cirrhosis, the kids that go into liver cirrhosis are old enough to remember. It's a very tough disease, as you would know from adults.
And we just have about a minute left, but what are the big questions you're asking as the field investigates this outbreak?
I think there's more to be learned. I think the best we can do is be vigilant, get the awareness out there, test for these kids when they come with jaundice and other things, test for these viruses, because if we don't test, we won't know. And we'll learn more.
Well, Dr. Rima Fawaz, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Rima Fawaz is an assistant professor of pediatrics at Yale University School of Medicine. She's the medical director for pediatric hepatology and pediatric liver transplantation. That is it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.